The Buddha talked about there being two key teachings, which in his understanding were central to the teaching of liberation. One of these was the teaching he offered on dependent origination, and the other was on the teaching of non-self. And it's this second one, non-self, that I'd like to reflect upon this afternoon. I'd like to start with a quote by Dogen, who was one of the most much respected elders, where he says, "To study the way is to study the self. To study oneself is to forget oneself. To forget oneself is to be awakened by all things. To be awakened by all things is to let body and mind of self and others fall away. Even the traces of awakening come to an end, and this traceless awakening is continued endlessly." Can you make any sense of that? So if you listen to enough Dharma teaching, if you read enough, if you practice enough in this particular path, there are two words that inevitably you are going to encounter. One of those words is anatta, and the other is shunyata. Now, anatta is usually translated as non-self. Be very mindful I'm using the phrase non-self and not no-self. Shunyata is usually translated as emptiness. Now, I find it interesting that many people have quite an emotional reaction to these words. Some people tell me when they hear these words of non-self or emptiness, to some extent they just sort of stop listening. They just kind of tune out and they feel it's too complex, they feel it's too unfathomable, that it's beyond their understanding, that they're too new in the practice to grapple with this. And they may feel that it has little to do with their practice or their world. You know, people say, "Look, I just came here for a little calm. What about this?" Not this non-self business, you know. That it's hard enough just to find a little tranquility, you know, and then you start talking about emptiness. Sometimes people tell me they have a little bit of aversion to these teachings of non-self or emptiness, that they hear them as a kind of a nihilistic view, as a prescription for passivity or a surrender of directedness or a surrender of relatedness, feeling like if I really lived in the understanding of non-self, what would get me out of bed in the morning? You know. Sometimes people tell me they hear the words non-self in a sort of accusation, as a kind of judgment, when their reality may be feeling to live in a world where they feel very much locked in the world of self. I think it's incredibly important to remember that the Buddha did not reserve these teachings on non-self or emptiness for only the very experienced students, you know, or only for the elite. In fact, this was the second discourse that the Buddha gave. This was the second discourse, second teaching that the Buddha gave. So when new students or disciples would turn up, often for the first time, the Buddha would immediately launch into the teaching of non-self. So clearly, certainly in the Buddha's thinking, a warm-up period wasn't necessary. That this was actually what the teaching of liberation was all about. So certainly, you know, as the Buddha talked about non-self, he really considered this understanding to be at the heart of the liberated mind, and that there was no better means to bring about the end of despair, the end of sorrow, the end of suffering, than to understand non-self. And rather than presenting non-self as being this incredibly sort of complex, unfathomable teaching, he actually spoke about non-self and emptiness as simple realities that were staring us in the face every moment of our lives. Now, this teaching of non-self, of course, is a teaching that spans all Buddhist traditions, but it's not restricted to Buddhism, isn't it? Science talks about non-self, totally in agreement. People speak at times, you know, people who've never had any practice, speak almost about encountering a collision with emptiness, you might say. Oliver Sacks, some of you will be familiar with his work, wrote about his big meeting with emptiness when he was recovering from a serious leg injury. He said, "After breakfast, I wandered out. It was a particularly glorious September morning. Settled myself on a stone seat with a large view in all directions and filled and lit my pipe. This was a new, or at least almost forgotten, experience. I had never had the leisure to light a pipe before, or not, it seemed to me, for 14 years at least. Now suddenly I had an immense sense of leisure, an unhurriedness, a freedom I had almost forgotten, but which, now it had returned, seemed the most precious thing in life. There was an intense sense of stillness, peacefulness, joy, a pure delight in the now, freed from drive or desire. I was intensely conscious of each leaf, autumn-tinted, on the ground, intensely conscious of the Eden around me. The world was motionless, everything concentrated in an intensity of sheer being. Now, on this morning, as though on the first morning of creation, I felt like Adam, beholding a new world with wonder. I had not known or had forgotten that there could be such beauty, such completeness, in every moment. I had no sense at all of moments, of the serial, only of the perfection and beauty of the timeless now." Dogen, again, put this in a different language. And he said that emptiness includes the sun, the moon, the stars and planets, the great earth, the mountains and rivers, all trees and grasses, bad people and good people, bad things and good things, heaven and hell. They are all in the midst of emptiness. Now, the Buddha presented anatta, or non-self, both as a teaching and as a practice, and ultimately as a way of seeing, as an embodiment of a liberated heart. As a teaching, the Buddha presented it very simply, saying that there is no thing that can be found, inwardly or outwardly, anywhere in the world, that has an independent self-existence. As a practice, he taught, saying, nothing that arises in body or mind should be regarded as mine, as me, as who I am, or as belonging to me. That nothing in the world that arises should be regarded as me or mine or belonging to me. Now, this practice naturally follows on from our own investigation of the teaching. And when the Buddha gave instructions in the practice, or when he was asked What does a mind liberated through emptiness look like? The Buddha answered, a monk or a nun gone to the forest or to the roots of a tree or to an empty hut reflects. This is empty of self, of what belongs to self, that this is the liberation of heart through emptiness. And the Buddha went on to describe this understanding of emptiness as the abode or the home of a noble person. Now, I think for the Buddha, and I think also for us, this practice of non-self was something of great immediacy, and it has a direction. And the contemplation and the practice of non-self is not in the service of erasing or annihilating the self. It's in the service of dispelling the confusion and the misery, the origins of suffering and torment. I think it is very, very important to remember that this kind of essence of the Buddha's teaching and the practice, you know, in this practice, you know, great meditative experiences may or may not come our way. You know, we may get incredibly concentrated. We may not get incredibly concentrated. But all of this, in a way, is very, very secondary. And I think what is primary in the teaching, the practice, and I think the primary longing for us is to bring about the end of suffering and torment and struggle by understanding its causes. And by understanding its causes and bringing about the end of struggle, that this is what opens the door to love, to compassion, to generosity, to kindness, all of the deep transformations we speak about in this teaching are said to arise from the understanding of non-self. So Dogen went on to say, you must surely know that emptiness is a perfect grass. This emptiness is bound to bloom like hundreds of grasses blooming. Seeing a dazzling variety of the flowers of emptiness, we surmise an infinity of the fruits of emptiness. We observe the bloom and the fall of the flowers of emptiness and learn the spring and the autumn of them. Let me think about this. Would we acknowledge in ourselves that every single quality of heart and mind that we really value, that we long for, that we see as being ennobling, our capacity to reach out in a loving way to another, our capacity to listen with empathy and compassion, our capacities for generosity. Do we notice that in these moments, when these qualities are present in our lives, they are the moments when the sense of I is most quiet? You notice that. It's when the sense of I is most quiet. Those moments when the sort of divisions between self and other kind of crumble a little bit and we find ourselves able to reach out, to touch another, with when we sense the stillness within ourselves that is able to embrace pain in the world. These are the moments when our desires to sort of assert or protect ourselves are actually most quiet. It's almost as if you can see the ways in which compassion and empathy and love are actually the flowers of non-self. We might also notice that the moments when we seem to suffer the most, when we feel most disconnected, when we feel most estranged from others, when we feel most fearful, the moments when we feel most gripped by ill will or craving, the most difficult times in our lives, have you noticed those are the moments when the sense of I feels the loudest? So when I'm saying, I am, you are, I need, I can't bear, we can see almost this solidifying of the sense of self in the moments of most distress. It's almost to say that suffering seems to be the bloom of confusion. Or that suffering seems to be the bloom of misunderstanding. If we can see for ourselves that the most spacious and the most peaceful moments in our lives are the moments of least self-preoccupation and self-absorption, then I think it's a good question to ask ourselves, what is it that leads to deny that spaciousness or that ease that is most liberating? What is it that locks us into a self-preoccupation and absorption which is really not the places we long to live in, not the places we want to be? I mean, first I want to just take a moment to look at why we struggle at times, why we have a kind of emotional resistance to the teaching of non-self. Because I think for sure if we struggle with the teaching of non-self, there, we probably won't practice it. I think that one of the primary reasons we struggle with the concept, never mind the reality or actuality of non-self, is because it seems to be the polar opposite of our felt experience. I mean, embarrassing it as it is to admit it, we do pretty much tend to see ourselves as being the center of the universe. Things happen to me. I make things happen. I self-reference all the time. Everything passes through the filters of my likes, my dislikes, my preferences. I mean, it's a curious thing. It's a kind of, I think of it as an optical illusion. You know, it's almost like the optical illusion of the sun, isn't it? I mean, most of us would agree that the sun does not orbit around us, do we? I mean, we're in agreement here. And yet, when we look at the sun, isn't it curious? It does look like it comes up over there and it goes down over there, and it does look like it's going around us, doesn't it? And we're the kind of center of the universe. It's a sort of optical illusion, isn't it? It's a sort of distortion of reality. I think a lot about this whole idea of me as the center of the universe is very, very similar. Again, when we wake up in the morning, doesn't it just feel like I'm waiting for me? I mean, it's so curious to me, like sometimes when I'm traveling a lot, you know, and I wake up in some strange bed, and there's a moment when I wake up and I don't know where I am. I have absolutely no idea where I am. And it's so curious, when I don't know where I am, I have no reference point. I actually don't even know who I am. You know, I sort of have a vague knowledge I'm here, but no idea what I'm doing here, what's going on. And then I can see sort of my eyes start to move around the room, you know, and identify the curtains, you know, and I identify that particular, you know, hotel chain desk, you know. And suddenly the thought arises, ah, I'm in San Francisco, I know exactly where I am, I know what I'm doing. It's like the whole world just gathers, you know, and here I am. But that moment is so interesting. I mean, when we wake up in the morning, it does feel, as I referred to yesterday, like I'm waiting for me, just like, you know, those familiar clothes in the wardrobe, I'm just going to put me on, you know, and then I'm just going to step in to, you know, it's as if my body and mind is just waiting to get into gear, you know, to move into all my plans, you know, my objectives, my projects of the day, you know, the things I don't like, and there I am, I'm going, I'm on my track. And therefore, I am me. I move into my wants, my fantasies. And it's interesting, so interesting, how we know ourselves by what we do, by what we perform, by what we like. It's like the story of Nasruddin, you know, who goes into the bank, you know, to cash a check. And and Nasruddin, the Sufi, kind of crazy Sufi teacher, and the bank teller says to him, have you gotten the identification? And Nasruddin says, have you got a mirror? And so the bank teller hands Nasruddin a mirror, he looks in it, he says, yep, that's me, all right. You know, it's kind of like, there I am. There I am. What happens is, as the center of the universe, of course, this is, goes without saying, we do tend to take things rather personally. Things happen to me. You happen to me. I make things happen. Things belong to me. The long detailed story of who I am. It's almost as if this sense of me is kind of like an enduring companion. Sometimes we experience that companion as our worst enemy, creating endless cycles of distress and judgment and fear and unworthiness. These are all the landscape of myself. And in truth, taking things quite personally, we can spend our whole lives protecting and improving, asserting, concealing, bettering, guess who? Me. My sense is being a self is almost like a full-time job. It's almost like a full-time job. It takes a lot of energy. Now, we could react to this sense of self-absorption with judgment or blame or condemnation, but it's really, that's a really kind of heaping selfing upon selfie. Another offshoot of self-absorption. Or we could, as the Buddha suggested, investigate. Be a little bit curious about this question, who am I anyway? Is my sense of self an idea or a reality? Is it something that is fixed or is it something that is changing? Does it have a kind of central core, or is there a kind of substantiality to it? Is me, I, a noun, or am I a process? Is there truly an independent self-existence? When people came to the Buddha arguing the case for self, because remember, in the time of the Buddha, this was very much the sort of ethos, was the eternal self, the Atman, you know, the self that never died. You know? So when people came to the Buddha arguing the case for self, he never said, oh yes, there is a self. He also never said, oh no, there is no self. But he encouraged to begin with an external contemplation, an external investigation. And the one that you see frequently used in Buddhist texts is he would take something like a cart, and he would encourage people to take the cart apart and say, well, is the wheel the cart? Is the shaft the cart? You know, is the kind of bed of it, is that the cart? Now, we don't have any handy carts in this room, but we can take a chair. Let's take a chair. Now, clearly, the chair exists. It's a chair. You know, it has an existence. You are not just sitting on an illusion. Otherwise, you would sprawl on the floor. You're not just sitting upon a construct of your mind. You are sitting on a chair. It has a conventional reality. Now, of course, you can do a lot with that chair. You could take it very personally. You know, if you came in and someone was sitting on your chair, then you would see, wouldn't you? You wouldn't even know you'd thought of it as your chair until somebody took your seat. Then you would see, my chair! You know, how dare you sit on my chair? And the whole kind of fabrication of you, as well as me, born on my chair. you could have, you know, all kinds of thoughts about this chair, you know, like it's not really a very good chair, it's a kid's chair, it needs to be a bigger chair, how can I sit on this chair, I have a better chair at home. We could do a lot with this chair. Does the chair have an independent self-existence? Okay, so if you look underneath the concept of chair, what do you see? It's not so. You really see, actually, that the chair is an ongoing story. If you look underneath the concept, what you see, of course, are all the people who are involved, perhaps, in making this chair. You see everything that went in, all the elements that went into what this chair is constructed. That chair was, you know, at one point, oil in the ground, the plastic of it. You know, you can see the process of constructing a chair. You can even see, amazing, the person who had, at one time, somebody had an idea a chair would be a good thing. And therefore, we had chairs. And if you look underneath the concept of the chairs, you see that it's not a finished story. At some point, this chair will turn into something else. Even though it may be a very long process, but at some point this chair will turn into something else. It does not have, it is not fixed, it hasn't, does not have an independent self-existence. What you actually see that there is a matrix of conditions, the beginnings of which are untraceable, that have all come together in a particular way to arrive at a chair. To arrive at a chair. And this in time will turn into something else. So when we speak about the emptiness of a chair, we are actually speaking about what is revealed when we probe beneath the surface of appearances. We're talking about what is revealed when we probe beneath the surface of concepts. So this is not a denial of the chair. It's not saying no chair. It's better to say you're sitting on a non-chair. When we can probe beneath the surface of concepts and appearances, I think we begin to open to the mystery and the depth and the interrelatedness of this fluid and changing life, where nothing at all can be pinned down. Nothing at all can be fixed by name or by concept or by belief. Emptiness, understanding it, really teaches us to let go about all fixed ideas about ourselves, about others, about the world. Because we see that when we start to fix something in place, in very real ways, we often cease to see. Isn't that true of the chair? You know? We know it. We have the concept of it. We don't see the chair anymore. We don't see that fluid, changing, mysterious combining of conditions because we think we know it. We do this at times to ourselves. At times we do it to others. And when we look underneath the concept, when we look beneath the surface of things, we see that nothing in reality in this world is fixed, is static, is set in place apart from our view of it. Like, you are not fixed in place apart from my view of you. You know, I cannot be fixed in place apart from your view of me that says you are like this, this is who you are, and therefore ceasing to see anymore. Now, it's like, you know, if you took a, like a really simple example, if you went into the, again, into the dining room, I always use the dining room because on retreats it tends to be for people, you know, the big event setting, and you're behind the person in line, you know, looking forward to the pasta salad, and there they go, take the last spoon of it. You know, not that you imagine they knew your longing for the pasta salad. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken taken the last spoon, would they? But there they go with the last spoon of pasta salad. The next time you see that person, do you see that person as this mysterious, unfolding person? Or are they forever in your mind, the person who took the last spoon of pasta salad? This happens a lot in our lives, doesn't it? It happens a lot in our lives. What we actually see in the practice is this tendency to try and fix things in place through our views is actually not a life sentence. That we can also acknowledge our views. And we can let our views take their seat in this fluid, mysterious, changing life. A seat which is also fluid. There is no centrality. That is what's so extraordinary. There is no centrality. And I think when we can see that without being afraid, instead of trying to control it and constantly create a centrality, we learn to open to the fluidity of all things, the fluidity of all views. That, I think, is a world of possibility. Whereas the world of views and setting people and things and ourselves in place is a world of almost impossibility. It is frozen. Nagarjuna, who was one of the poets of emptiness, he said that the Buddha say that emptiness is relinquishing opinions. And that the knowers of emptiness are incurable. Now, all scientists, all Buddhas, all people who walk this path, I think, are not in disagreement, at least on an intellectual level, that there is nothing that is fixed or solid in the world. And yet we can be strangely reluctant to apply that same investigation and understanding to ourselves. We often find ourselves in the place of saying, this is me, this is who I am, this is all that belongs to me. As much as we can sense the freedom of understanding and living in the light of emptiness, at the same time it can be so deeply unsettling when applied to ourselves. It can feel like almost an intolerable assault or insult to our sense of identity, which, as difficult as it can sometimes be, is also what provides us with a sense of safety and security and perspective from which we can know the world. Now, clearly there is a sense of self. Just like the chair has a conventional reality, so do we. Before awakening, there will be a sense of self. After awakening, there will be a sense of self. Made up of body, of perceptions, of experiences, of emotions, of intentions of mind, and of course we will have a name, the standard bearer, almost a standard bearer that marks my distinction out. I mean, you notice if we sat here, you know, very quietly, and we all sat here in a sitting with our eyes closed, and I suddenly shouted out, Sally, you know, like if your name wasn't Sally, you know, like you just look at some kind of weird thing up there in the front of the room, but if your name was Sally, what would it be like? You're suddenly hyper alert. You know, I'm being called my name. Have you ever been in a situation where somebody forgets your name and they call you Fred instead of Sam? You know, and you feel this kind of sense of insult, you know, like they've forgotten who I am. I've become invisible. You know, I don't matter. I'm just, you know, this kind of invisible person. We feel these surges of selfing all the time. I mean, we do hear, I think, these competing voices within ourselves, you know. part of us feels this kind of longing for freedom, the freedom from self-absorption with all its offspring of judgment and fear and anxiety. But we often hear the story and the longing for self-absorption. It's like, I'm here, you know, see me, I'm lovable, I'm actually, pay attention to me. I remember when my children were small, you know, one of their mantras, and I think this is true of many children, is, look at me. You know, look at me. And I think actually that just gets we're a little bit more sophisticated as we mature. But we're still in there saying, look at me. You know, look at me, hopefully with approving eyes, you know, and with love and praise and all the rest of it. So what do we do with this kind of, you know, this longing for freedom and this habit of self-absorption? Well, we don't turn away. We don't pretend it doesn't exist. We don't condemn it. We simply calm our hearts and look just a little bit more deeply. Now, we can use the same analytical skills that we apply to the chair to ourselves. The Buddha really encouraged us to understand the anatomy of a self, to understand the anatomy of our self. Okay, so first we could start with investigating the body. Now, if the body was me, who I am, belonged to me, if the body had an independent self-existence, not entwined with countless other conditions, I suspect the logical conclusion of that would be that basically we could all have the body we wanted. We would have a body that didn't age. We would have a body that looked the way that we wanted it to look. And we all know this is simply not an option. Even a cursory investigation of our body reveals our body subject to exactly the same conditions as the chair. Born of conditions, subject to conditions, changed by conditions. Not under our dominion. Now, isn't this also true? Let's turn that same analytical skill towards feelings. Okay, so if our feelings were ours, me, belonged to me, under my dominion, under my control, then we could probably have a menu of the feelings that we want to have. And we know that we don't have a menu. We can't decide today only to have pleasant experiences and no unpleasant experiences. We can't choose to inhabit a landscape only of delight, of bliss, of elation, of love. How about consciousness? How about consciousness today? You've had a little time to, you know, be close to your own consciousness. How many of the thoughts you experienced today did you invite? How many of the mental states did you decide to come here today and have an uninterrupted day of happy mental states and lovely thoughts and no unhappy mental states and no difficult thoughts? You probably noticed how it actually didn't work. You notice in yourself that everything is changing, nothing is fixed, nothing is static. If the self had an independent self-existence with dominion and control, quite frankly, it's not doing a very good job. Simply not doing a very good job. So where does the idea come from? This is mine. This belongs to me. Where does that come from? At what point does this fluid unfolding process become fixed and solid and set into an identity? But when the Buddha looked at this, he said really there's two factors that are kind of the parent of confusion and the parent of suffering. He said one of the factors, of course, is ignorance, is not knowing, is not understanding the way things are. And he says the other factor that sets things in place is clinging or grasping. Now, I think intellectually we can maybe accept that there isn't a pilot in the cockpit, not in this cockpit. There isn't a pilot in the cockpit controlling, deciding on everything that happens in my mind-body experience. Now, interestingly, emotionally, I don't give up hope. I valiantly keep on trying, arguing, struggling with what is, adding to the simple truth of every moment, my demands, my fears, my likes, my dislikes, through every moment of resistance and craving, of wanting, not wanting. It's the way I can torment myself. It's the way I can struggle to deny emptiness, to deny non-self. Now, certainly in Buddhist teaching, this is described as being really quite an optional struggle. You know, that it's quite optional. And its ending of that struggle is in liberation. So let's take this teaching of no thing has an independent self-existence, and that we intellectually accept, and look at what it might mean as a practice. Well, first of all, I think it only takes a short time of really being aware of what the process of selfing inwardly, to see that self is not a noun, but it is a verb. There is not a self, there is self-being. That it is a process, like all things, that arises and passes almost like a reflex action. Now, this process of selfing arises in the face of, or the intimation of, pain or injury or loss or the unknown. We can feel the process of selfing arising. I don't want, I fear, I push away, I'm contracted. The process of selfing also arises in relationship to the pleasant, in the face of the pleasant. Food, sights, sounds, people, thoughts, I want. Suddenly I'm leaning forward, I'm becoming what I want. Now, it's very important to get a felt sense of the process of selfing, because it's a very felt sense. It's a tightening of the body. There's an energetic surge. There's a contractedness of heart and mind. There's a creation of a kind of tunnel vision that excludes much of the moment and only focuses upon what is immediately threatening or possibly gratifying to me. Notice the felt sense of selfing. Again, you know, if we're, you know, in here and I suddenly stand up in the middle of a sitting and offer an award to Fred for being the best meditator of the day, you know, Fred could probably feel that. Whew, you know, I'm being singled out, you know, with praise. I've really graduated here and I'm really someone, you know. Whereas Sam over there might hear that and say, oh, you know, once more I didn't get the medal, you know, and I'm a failure. And you can feel that energetic surge, can't you? It's a kind of like, selfing, I mean, I'm getting tighter, I'm getting more contracted, I'm getting more tunnel vision. And of course it evokes all our historical memories that reinforce that. No, because underlying that felt sense of selfing, there is the background ongoing symphony that this is me, mine belongs to me. Now at times, I think in our wiser moments and our more compassionate moments, when we're really aware of the painfulness of selfing, the painfulness of contractedness, we tell ourselves that it would be a good idea to let go. But even that suggestion, I think, carries its own delusion. Because again, even that telling ourselves to let go is positioning a centrality of self. It's positioning a centrality of me, as if I can decide to let go. As if I decided to cling. Or as if I decided to identify. I mean, I'm pretty confident that I have never let go of a single thing in my entire life. Pretty confident of that. What I do see in practice is certainly cultivating the understanding and the insight and the conditions that allows letting go to happen. But you can see how much we centralize selfing in both clinging and letting go. I'm a very poor meditator because I cling to things. I identify things. Isn't it actually more true that clinging and selfing are almost interchangeable words? That clinging is almost the activity of a belief system of misunderstanding? That it's not that I do it, and I also do not let go. We are cultivating, what we do cultivate is the conditions that allows the seeing of this. It allows the cultivation of the understanding. I would also suggest that there are many, many moments of non-selfing in each of our days. And I encourage you to notice those moments. When this contractedness is not happening, when we're not laying claim to territory of me, of mine, inwardly or outwardly, I would suggest there are many moments in our day when those activities are not going on. When you step outside, and there's a tremendous sense of ease, of being present with everything, of not wanting anything, not planning anything, but a simple, remarkable aliveness. I think, have you ever found yourself sitting or walking and just forgotten that you are sitting or walking? And when the walking is just walking itself, and the sitting is just happening. Have you ever found yourself in mindfulness of breathing just actually forgetting that you're the breather and the breathing is just breathing itself? Have you ever found yourself in listening or in seeing just for a moment forgetting that it is you who are listening or you who are seeing? And in those moments, almost as we have moments of the greatest aliveness in our lives, but there's much, many more small, many more mundane moments. Brushing your teeth. Are you always the brusher? Isn't it? The very many small moments in our day, actually when we're not centralizing, when we're not clinging, when there's not selfing, when there's no thing being fixated upon. It's really important to notice those moments because those are the moments when you see the boundaries soften. The boundaries between self and other, I and you, inner and outer, you know, me and the world. Those are the moments when all of the boundaries just begin to soften. And, you know, in many of these moments in our day that are there, they are a little bit of a taste of emptiness. A little bit of a taste of emptiness. They're not dramatic, but the quiet moments in our day when our hearts are not gripped by views, by aversion, by craving. We have all had plenty of practice, I think, selfing, practicing, solidify. But we can also learn to practice non-selfing. We can learn to practice non-clinging and to notice those little tastes of emptiness. It's like Leonard Cohen once said, ring the bells that can still ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That is how the light gets in. That is how the light gets in. Emptiness, as it's taught in this teaching, is not a state. It's a way, it's a path. And it's a path of getting in touch with the many moments in our day where we feel this opening and then this closing, the expanding and then the contracting, that we sense in our bodies, our minds, our hearts, countless times in a single day, in the face of sights, of sounds, of people and events. And closing, you get the sense, is the mechanism of selfing, of clinging, born of seeing substantiality, born of seeing independent self-existence in all things. Opening, we might say, is actually the response of emptiness to emptiness. It's a response of non-self to non-self. The very real question to ask ourselves is, does this sense of opening, this sense of expansiveness, this sense of the permeability of boundaries, does it need to be left to chance? Do those moments have to be lucky accidents? I think not. You know, perhaps we can see the moments of closing and contractedness as suffering, as a process that sets us apart, isolates, estranges. And perhaps we can see opening as an end of disconnection and an end of suffering. And perhaps we can learn particularly to probe beneath the surface of our views, to probe beneath the surface of our concepts, our likes and our dislikes. Perhaps we can begin to soften and open in the midst of contractedness. It's not trying to annihilate anything. It's not even trying to annihilate myself. Rumi once said, "Being is not what it seems, nor non-being. The world's existence is not in the world. The world's shape is not in the world. The world's shape is in my view. You know, the shape of you is in my view. It is not necessarily in you." Before awakening, there is a sense of self. After awakening, there is a sense of self. But what is different is the view. What is really different is the view. No longer seeing the substantiality. Still getting up in the morning. Breathing. Moving through your day. Attending to what needs attending to. But without wrong view. Without the view of substantiality, of solidity, of independent self-existence. And, you know, that poet of emptiness, Nagarjuna, the other poet of emptiness is Shantideva. And Shantideva really taught that this understanding of emptiness has profound ethical implications. That this understanding of non-self has profound implications in terms of compassion. That when we are no longer locked into the world of self-view, when we are locked in the world of self-view, there's tremendous room for a lot of ill will, hostility, craving, rejection, and fear. To be no longer locked in the world of self-view, there is tremendous room for compassion, for healing, for empathy, for generosity. In fact, Shantideva says these are the most natural embodiments of understanding emptiness. Shantideva once said in one of his poems, he says, "Just as these arms and legs are seen as limbs of a body, why are embodied creatures not seen as the limbs of life?" It is really that profound understanding of emptiness. I'd like to end, if I can find it, the verse from Kenpo Rinpoche, where he says, "Look inward at your own mind. It seems quite exciting when not examined. But when examined, there's nothing to it. Appearing without being, it is nothing but empty. It cannot be identified saying that's it. Elusive like mist. Look at whatever may appear in any of the 10 directions. No matter how it may appear, the thing in itself, its very nature, is the skylight nature of mind. beyond the projection and dissolution of thought and concept. Everything has the nature of being empty. When the empty looks at the empty, who is there to look at something empty?